Officially, Sal, this trip is to get a Mexican divorce, cheaper and quicker than any kind. I have Camille's agreement at last, and everything is straight. Everything is fine. Everything is lovely. And we know that we are not now worried about a single thing, don't we, Sal? That night, there was a party at Ed Dunkel's house. There was a lovely spread on the table, cake and drinks. Ed looked happy and prosperous. Well, are you all set with Galatea now, I asked. Yes, sir, said Ed, I sure am. I'm about to go to Denver, you know. What are you going to take up? Oh, sociology and all that field, you know. Say, Dean gets crazier every year, doesn't he? He sure does. Hup, hup, Dean was saying, tugging at his shirt, rubbing his belly, jumping up and down. Yes, well, we're all together now, and the years have rolled severally behind us. And yet, you see, none of us have really changed. That's what's so amazing. The durability. Then Dean suddenly grew quiet and sat in a kitchen chair between Stan and me and stared straight ahead with rocky, dog-like wonder and paid no attention to anybody. Then his face lit up with a lovely smile and he looked around like a man waking up and said, Ah, look at all the nice people that are sitting here with me. Isn't it nice? Sal, why, like I was telling Min just the other day, Why, yes. He got up and went across the room, hand outstretched to one of the party. How do you do? My name is Dean Moriarty. Yes, I remember you well. Is everything all right? Well, look at that lovely cake. Oh, can I have some? And he stood swaying in the middle of the room, eating his cake and looking at everyone with awe. People were now beginning to look at Dean with maternal and paternal affection glowing in their faces. He was finally an angel. But like any angel, he still had rages and furies. And that night when we all left the party and repaired to the Windsor Bar, Dean became frantically and demoniacally and seraphically drunk. It was our last night in Holy Denver. We made it big and wild. It all ended up with wine in the basement by candlelight and Charity creeping around upstairs in her nightgown with a flashlight. At 9 o'clock in the morning, everybody had left except Dean and Shepard, who were still yakking like maniacs. People upstairs got up to make breakfast and heard strange subterranean voices saying, Yes, yes. Babe cooked a big breakfast. The time was coming to scat off to Mexico. Dean took the car to the nearest station and had everything ship-shape. It was a 37 Ford sedan with the right-hand door unhinged and tied on the frame. The right-hand front seat was also broken. And you sat there leaning back with your face to the tattered roof. Just like Min and Bill, said Dean. We'll go coughing and bouncing down to Mexico. It'll take us days and days. I looked over the map, a total of over 1,000 miles. Man, this will finally take us to it, said Dean with definite faith. He tapped my arm. Just wait and see. Hoo-wee! We met Stan's mother at the bank where she was drawing money for him. She was a lovely white-haired woman, still very young in appearance. Stan was wearing a Levi outfit, jacket and all, and looked like a man going to Mexico, sure enough. This was his tender existence in Denver, and he was going off with the flaming Dean. Dean came popping around the corner and met us just on time. Mrs. Shepherd insisted on buying us all a cup of coffee. Take care of my Stan, she said. No telling what things might happen in that country. We roared off. Across the immense plain of night lay the first Texas town, Dalhart, which I'd crossed in 47. On the horizon was the moon. She fattened, she grew huge and rusty, she mellowed and rolled. After Dalhart, we bowled for Amarillo and reached it in the morning among windy panhandle grasses that only a few years ago waved around a collection of buffalo tents. Now there were gas stations and new 1950 jukeboxes with immense ornate snouts and 10-cent slots and awful songs. At Childress, in the hot sun, we turned directly south on a lesser road and highballed across abysmal wastes to Paducah, Guthrie, and Abilene, Texas. We burned slowly into Abilene and stopped to eat on the highway south of town. I took the wheel and drove to Fredericksburg. The car pushed 40 with shuddering effort. From Fredericksburg, we descended the Great Western High Plains. Moths began smashing our windshield. Getting down into the hot country now, boys, the desert rats and the tequila. And this is my first time this far south in Texas, added Dean in wonder. God damn. He took the wheel to roll us into San Antonio. We entered town in a wilderness of Mexican rickety southern shacks without cellars and with old rocking chairs on the porch. We stopped at a gas station to get a grease job. All around there were drooping trees and a wild cinnamon smell in the air. Now we were ready for the last 150 miles to the magic border. We leaped into the car and off. I was so exhausted, I slept all the way through Dilley and Ensenal to Laredo and didn't wake up till they were parking the car in front of a lunchroom at 2 o'clock in the morning. Ah, sighed Dean, the end of Texas, the end of America, we don't know no more. It was tremendously hot. We were all sweating buckets. There was no night dew, not a breath of air, nothing except billions of moths smashing at bulbs everywhere, and the low, rank smell of a hot river in the night nearby, the Rio Grande, that begins in cool, rocky mountain dales and ends up fashioning world valleys to mingle its heats with the Mississippi muds in the Great Gulf. Laredo was a sinister town that morning. All kinds of border rats wandering around looking for opportunities. But everything changed when we crossed the bridge over the river and our wheels rolled on official Mexican soil. It was 3 a.m, and fellows in straw hats and white pants were lounging by the dozen against battered, pocky storefronts. It was only Nuevo Laredo, but it looked like Holy Lhasa to us. We hurried to get our papers straightened. We were warned not to drink tap water now we were over the border. The Mexicans looked at our baggage in a desultory way. They weren't like officials at all. They were lazy and tender. Dean couldn't stop staring at them. See how the cops are in this country? I can't believe it. He rubbed his eyes. I'm dreaming. Then it was time to change our money. We saw great stacks of pesos on a table and learned that 8 of them made an American buck or thereabouts. We changed most of our money and stuffed the big rolls in our pockets with delight. That's all. A Mexican official grinned. You boys all set. You go ahead. Welcome, Mexico. Have a good time. Watch your money. Watch your driving. Eat good. Don't worry. It's not hard to enjoy yourself in Mexico. Yes, shuddered Dean, and off he went across the street on soft feet. We left the car parked, and all 3 of us abreast went down the Spanish street into the middle of the dull brown lights. Old men sat on chairs in the night and looked like Oriental junkies and oracles. Nobody was actually looking at us, yet everybody was aware of everything we did. We turned sharp left into the smoky lunchroom and went into music of campo guitars. We bought 3 bottles of cold beer. Cerveza was the name of beer, for about 30 Mexican cents or 10 American cents each. We bought packs of Mexican cigarettes for 6 cents each. We gazed and gazed at our wonderful Mexican money that went so far and played with it and looked around and smiled at everyone. We went back to the car. One last glimpse of America across the hot lights of the Rio Grande Bridge. We turned our back to it and roared off. Instantly, we were out in the desert, and there wasn't a light or a car for 50 miles across the flats. And just then, dawn was coming up over the Gulf of Mexico, and we began to see the ghostly shapes of yucca cactus and organ pipe on all sides. What a wild country, I yelped. Dean and I were completely awake. In Laredo, we'd been half dead. Stan, who'd been to foreign countries before, just calmly slept in the back seat. Dean and I had the whole of Mexico before us. Now, Sal, we're leaving everything behind us and entering a new and unknown phase of things. All the years and troubles and kicks, and now this. So we can safely think of nothing else and just go on ahead with our faces stuck out like this, you see, and understand the world as, really and genuinely speaking, other Americans haven't done before us. They were here, weren't they? The Mexican War, cutting across here with cannon. This road, I told him, is also the route of old American outlaws who used to skip over the border and go down to Monterey. So if you'll look out on that graying desert and picture the ghost of a tombstone hellcat, making his lonely exile gallop into the unknown. You'll see farther. It's the world, said Dean. My God, he cried, slapping the wheel. It's the world. We can go right on to South America if the road goes. Think of it. Son of a bitch. God damn. We arrived at Sabinas Hidalgo, across the desert, at about 7 o'clock in the morning. We slowed down. We sat up straight to dig. The main street was muddy and full of holes. On each side were dirty, broken-down adobe fronts. Burros walked in the street with packs. Barefoot women watched us from dark doorways. The street was crowded with people on foot beginning a new day in the Mexican countryside. We stopped for gas the other side of town. Across the fields, an old man plodded with a burro in front of his switch stick. Now we resumed the road to Monterey. The great mountains rose snow-capped before us. A gap widened and wound up a pass, and we went with it. In a matter of minutes, we were out of the mesquite desert and climbing among cool airs in a road with a stone wall along the precipice side and great whitewashed names of presidents on the cliff sides. Alaman. We met nobody on this high road. It wound among the clouds and took us to the great plateau on top. Across this plateau, the big manufacturing town of Monterey sent smoke to the blue skies with their enormous gulf clouds written across the bowl of day like fleece. Entering Monterey was like entering Detroit among great long walls of factories, except for the burros that sunned in the grass before them and the sight of thick city adobe neighborhoods. Yow, yelled Dean. Have you dug this Mexican sun, Sal? It makes you high. Whoo! Montemorelos was ahead, a descent again to hotter altitudes. I took the wheel and drove through Linares, through hot, flat swamp country, across the steaming Rio Soto La Marina near Hidalgo. Groups of men watched us pass from a narrow old-fashioned bridge. The river flowed. Then we rose in altitude till a kind of desert country began reappearing. The city of Gregoria was ahead. The boys were sleeping. I was alone at the wheel, and the road ran straight as an arrow. As I pulled up the car at a gas station near sunny Gregoria, a kid came across the road on tattered feet, carrying an enormous windshield shade. He wanted to know if I'd buy. You like? 60 peso. Hablo español? 60 peso. My name Victor. Nah, I said jokingly. We buy senorita. Sure, sure, he cried excitedly. I get you girls anytime. I woke up Dean. Hey, man, stretch your bones. We've got girls waiting for us. What? What? He cried, leaping up, haggard. Where? Where? This boy Victor's going to show us where. Well, let's go, let's go. Dean jumped out of the car and clasped Victor's hand. Victor, you got girls? Where? A donde? He cried in Spanish. Dig that, Sal? I'm speaking Spanish. Ask him if we can get any tea. Hey, kid, you got marijuana? The kid nodded gravely. Sure, any time, man. Come with me. Hee-hoo! Yow! Yelled Dean. He was wide awake and jumping up and down in that drowsy Mexican street. Let's go! Victor got in the car with us and we lurched off. Stan Shepard had been sleeping soundly and woke up to this madness. We drove out to the desert, the other side of town, and turned on a rutty dirt road that made the car bounce as never before. Up ahead was Victor's house. It sat on the edge of cactus flats, overtopped by a few trees, just an adobe cracker box, with men lounging around in the yard. Who that? Cried Dean, all excited. Those my brothers. My mother there, too. My sister, too. That my family. I'm married. I live downtown. Victor got out and loped over to the house and said a few words to an old lady, who promptly turned and went to the garden and back and began gathering dry fronds of marijuana that had been pulled off the plants and left to dry in the desert sun. Victor came back, grinning sweetly. You see how hot? He said, sitting down with Dean in the front seat and pointing at the burning roof of the car. You have marijuana and eat no hot, no move. You wait. Presently, Victor's tall brother came ambling along with some weed piled on a page of newspaper. He dumped it on Victor's lap and leaned casually on the door of the car to nod and smile at us. Nobody talked. It was fine. Victor proceeded to roll the biggest bomber anybody ever saw. He rolled, using brown bag paper, what amounted to a tremendous Corona cigar of tea. Dean stared at it, pop-eyed. Victor casually lit it and passed it around. To drag on this thing was like leaning over a chimney. It blew into your throat in one great blast of heat. We held our breaths and all let out just about simultaneously. Instantly, we were high. The sweat froze on our foreheads, and it was suddenly like the beach at Acapulco. And everybody grew quiet and cool and just enjoyed the breeze from the desert and mused separate personal high eternity thoughts. It was time for the girls, and we slowly bounced back to town. But now the bouncing was no longer unpleasant. It was the most graceful, billowy trip in the world, as over a blue sea. And Dean's face was suffused with an unnatural glow that was like gold as he told us to understand the springs of the car now for the first time and to dig the ride. Up and down we bounced and laughed. Then Victor pointed left, and Dean pulled the wheel round and rolled us smoothly and surely to our goal, meanwhile listening to Victor's attempt to speak and saying grandly and magniloquently, "Yes, of course. There's not a doubt in my mind. Decidedly, man. Oh, indeed. Why, pish posh, you say the dearest things to me? Of course, yes. Please go on." To this, Victor talked gravely and with magnificent Spanish eloquence. For a moment, I thought Dean was understanding everything he said by sheer wild insight and sudden revelatory genius, inconceivably inspired by his glowing happiness. In that moment, too, he looked so exactly like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, some delusion in my flaming eyes and floating brain, that I drew up in my seat and gasped in amazement. I was so high I had to lean my head back on the seat. The bouncing of the car sent shivers of ecstasy through me. I saw streams of gold pouring through the sky and right across the tattered roof of the poor old car, right across my eyeballs and indeed right inside them. It was everywhere. I looked out the window at the hot sunny streets and saw a woman in a doorway, and I thought she was listening to every word we said and nodding to herself. And the stream of gold continued. We came to the whorehouse. It was a magnificent establishment of stucco in the golden sun. There we found the girls. Some of them were reclining on couches across the dance floor. Some of them were boozing at the long bar to the right. In the center, an arch led to some small cubicle shacks that looked like the places where you put on your bathing suit at municipal beaches. These shacks were in the sun of the court. Behind the bar was the proprietor, a young fellow who instantly ran out when we told him we wanted to hear mambo music and came back with a stack of records, mostly by Perez Prado, and put them on over the loudspeaker. In an instant, all the city of Gregoria could hear the good times going on at the Sala de Baile. The din was so tremendous that it shattered Dean and Stan and me for a moment in the realization that we had never dared to play music as loud as we wanted, and this was how loud we wanted. More mambo jambo, Chattanooga de mambo, mambo numero oco. All these tremendous numbers resounded and flared in the golden, mysterious afternoon like the sounds you expect to hear on the last day of the world. The trumpets seemed so loud, I thought they could hear them clear out in the desert, where trumpets had originated. The drums were mad. The mambo beat is the conga beat from Congo, the river of Africa and the world. It's really the world beat. Oom-ta-da-boom-boom, oom-ta-da-boom-boom. The final trumpet choruses froze Dean in his tracks for a moment till he shuddered. I myself was shaken like a puppet by them. I heard the trumpets flail the light I had seen, and I trembled in my boots. They were great girls. The wildest one was half Indian, half white, came from Venezuela, and only 18. She drank beyond all bounds. She threw down drinks when it seemed she was about to chuck up the last. Wearing her flimsy house coat, she frantically danced with Dean and clung about his neck and begged for everything. Dean was so stoned he didn't know what to start with, girls or mambo. They ran off to the lockers. I was set upon by a fat girl with a puppy dog. She got sore at me when I took a dislike to the dog because it kept trying to bite me. She compromised by putting it away in the back. But by the time she returned, I had been hooked by another girl, better looking but not the best, who clung to me like a leech. Stan had a 15-year-old with an almond-colored skin and a dress that was buttoned halfway down and halfway up. I let the leech take me off to the back where, as in a dream, to the din and roar of more loudspeakers, we made the bed bounce. It was just a square room with wooden slats and no ceiling, an icon in a corner, a wash basin in another. All up and down the hall, the girls were calling, "Agua, agua caliente." Stan and Dean were also out of sight. My girl charged 30 pesos, or about $3.50, and begged for an extra 10 pesos and gave a long story about something. I threw money at her. We rushed back to dance. Dean's pretty Venezuelan dragged me through a door and into another strange bar that apparently belonged to the whorehouse. Here, too, the mambo roared. Venezuela held me close and begged for drinks. The bartender wouldn't give her one. "Take it easy, baby," I told her. I've never seen a drunker woman, and only 18. I bought her another drink. She was tugging at my pants for mercy. She gulped it up. We rushed off to her room. Dean and Stan switched the girls they'd had before. The afternoon grew long and cool. Soon it would be mysterious night in old gone Gregoria. The bill was over 300 pesos, or 36 American dollars, which is a lot of money in any whorehouse. We staggered out. We had forgotten Stan. We ran back in to get him and found him bowing to the evening whores who had just come in for the night shift. He wanted to start all over again. Dean and I pounded him on the back and dragged him out. It was all over. We pulled out and left joys and celebrations over hundreds of pesos behind us, and it didn't seem like a bad day's work. The haunting mambo followed us a few blocks. "Goodbye, Gregoria," cried Dean, blowing it a kiss. Immediately outside Gregoria, the road began to drop. Great trees arose on each side. A great, rank, rotten smell descended, and we remembered that the map indicated just after Gregoria the beginning of the Tropic of Cancer. We're in a new tropic. No wonder the smell. Smell it. I stuck my head out of the window. Bugs smashed at my face. I cocked my ear to the wind. Suddenly, Limon appeared before us, a jungle town. A few brown lights, dark shadows, enormous skies overhead, and a cluster of men in front of a jumble of wood shacks, tropical crossroads. We stopped in the unimaginable softness. It was as hot as the inside of a baker's oven on a June night in New Orleans. All up and down the street, whole families were sitting around in the dark, chatting. Occasional girls came by, curious to see what we looked like. Now we were so tired we had to sleep at once and move the car a few yards down a dirt road to the back side of town. Dean took a blanket and laid it out on the hot, soft sand in the road and flopped out. Stan was stretched on the front seat with both doors open for a draft, but there wasn't even the faintest puff of wind. I jumped on the steel roof of the car and stretched out flat on my back. Still there was no breeze, but the steel had an element of coolness in it and dried my back of sweat. For the first time in my life, the weather was not something that touched me, that caressed me, froze or sweated me, but became me. The atmosphere and I became the same. I began to tingle all over and to smell of the rank, hot, and rotten jungle, all over from hair and face to feet and toes. A huddle of darkness on the road showed where Dean was sleeping. I could hear him snoring. Stan was snoring, too. Occasionally, a dim light flashed in town, and this was the sheriff making his rounds. I saw his light jiggling towards us and heard his footfalls coming soft on the mats of sand and vegetation. He stopped and flashed the car. I sat up and looked at him. He said, "Dormiendo?" indicating Dean on the road. I knew this meant sleep. "Sí, dormiendo." "Bueno, bueno," he said, and turned away and went back to his lonely rounds. Such lovely policemen God hath never wrought in America. Roosters began to crow the dawn across the break somewhere. I heard dogs barking. Stan Shepherd slowly woke up. "You know, I'm beginning to like this smell," he said. "I can't smell myself anymore." "It's a strange good smell," said Dean, yawning, stretching, and scratching himself. "I'm not going to change my shirt till Mexico City. I want to take it all in and remember it. Off we roared again, creating air for our hot-caked faces. Then the mountains loomed ahead, all green. In no time at all, we soared to an elevation of 5,000 feet among misty passes that overlooked steaming yellow rivers a mile below. It was the great river Moctezuma. The Indians along the road were short and squat and dark. They carried immense loads on their backs. Across enormous ravines, we saw patchworks of agriculture on steep slopes. They walked up and down those slopes and worked the crops. High on the highest peak, as great as any Rocky Mountain peak, we saw bananas growing. As we climbed, the air grew cooler and the Indian girls on the road wore shawls over their heads and shoulders. We came into the dizzying heights of the Sierra Madre Oriental. The banana trees gleamed golden in the haze. Great fogs yawned beyond stone walls along the precipice. Below the Moctezuma was a thin golden thread in a green jungle mat. We had reached the approaches of the last plateau. Now the sun was golden, the air keen blue, and the desert with its occasional rivers a riot of sandy, hot space and occasional tree shade. The shepherds appeared, dressed in long flowing robes, the women carrying bundles of flax, the men staves. Under great trees on the shimmering desert, the shepherds sat, and the sheep moiled in the sun and raised dust. The end of our journey impended. The clouds were close and huge and rose. Mexico City by dusk. We'd made it. A total of 1,900 miles from Denver. And now we were about to reach the end of the road. A brief mountain pass took us suddenly to a height from which we saw all of Mexico City stretched out in its volcanic crater below and spewing city smokes and early dusk lights. Down to it we zoomed, down Insurgentes Boulevard, straight towards the heart of town at Reforma. Long, ragged adobe slums stretched out on the plain. We saw lonely figures in the dimming alleys. Soon night would come. Then the city roared in, and suddenly we were passing crowded cafes and theaters and many lights. The noise was incredible. No mufflers are used on Mexican cars. Horns are batted with glee continual. "Whee!" yelled Dean. "Look out!" He staggered the car through the traffic and played with everybody. He drove like an Indian. He got on a circular Glorieta drive on Reforma Boulevard and rolled around it with its eight spokes shooting cars at us from all directions. Left, right, izquierda, dead ahead, and yelled and jumped with joy. "This is traffic I've always dreamed of. Everybody goes!" Mambo blared from everywhere. Hundreds of horrors lined themselves along the dark and narrow streets, and their sorrowful eyes gleamed at us in the night. We wandered in a frenzy and a dream. We ate beautiful steaks for 48 cents in strange tiled cafeterias with generations of musicians standing at one immense marimba. Nothing stopped. The streets were alive all night. Dean walked through with his arms hanging zombie-like at his sides, his mouth open, his eyes gleaming, and conducted a ragged and holy tour that ended at dawn in a field with a boy in a straw hat who laughed and chatted with us and wanted to play catch, for nothing ever ended. Then I got fever and became delirious and unconscious. Dysentery. I looked up out of the dark swirl of my mind, and I knew I was on a bed 8,000 feet above sea level, on a roof of the world, and I had all the dreams. And I saw Dean bending over the kitchen table. It was several nights later. He was leaving Mexico City already. "What are you doing, man?" I moaned. "Poor Sal. Poor Sal got sick. Stan will take care of you. Now listen to here if you can in your sickness. I got my divorce from Camille down here, and I'm driving back to Inez in New York tonight if the car holds out." "All that again?" I cried. "All that again, good buddy. Got to get back to my life. Wish I could stay with you." And he was gone. I grabbed the cramps in my belly and groaned. When I got better, I realized what a rat he was. But then I had to understand the impossible complexity of his life. how he had to leave me there, sick, to get on with his wives and woes. Okay, old Dean, I'll say nothing. Dean drove from Mexico City and saw Victor again in Gregoria and pushed that old car all the way to Lake Charles, Louisiana, before the rear end finally dropped on the road as he had always known it would. When he finally arrived in New York, he and Inez immediately got married. And that night, telling her everything was all right and not to worry, he jumped on a bus and roared off again across the awful continent to San Francisco to rejoin Camille and the two baby girls. So now he was three times married, twice divorced, and living with his second wife. In the fall, I myself started back from Mexico City. I struggled and hurried to New York. One night I was standing in a dark street in Manhattan, and I called up to the window of a loft where I thought my friends were having a party. A pretty girl stuck her head out and said, "Yes, who is it?" "Sal Paradise," I said, and heard my name resound in the sad and empty street. "Come up," she called. "I'm making hot chocolate." So I went up, and there she was, the girl with the pure and innocent eyes that I had searched for so long. We agreed to love each other. That made all the difference. Well, almost all the difference. Nowadays, when the sun goes down and I sit on the old river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey, and I sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievably huge bulge over to the West Coast, and all that road, all those people, dreaming in the immensity of it. And in Iowa, I know by now the children must be crying in the land where they let the children cry. Tonight the stars will be out. The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens the rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. And nobody, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. Nowadays, when the sun goes down and I sit on the old river pier, I think of Dean Moriarty. I think of Dean Moriarty.